Yeah, so this is the idea, I guess. I mean, for after this, I don't know, 7 lectures that I've given, I'm seriously hoping that I would have some rest. So I propose that we do so organize these practicals in such a way that you present your solutions and we discuss them. Hi, Thomas. Maybe do something additional to that, and there are some programming exercises, so you can also and when we come to them, you can also maybe connect your laptop to the beamer and show your show your solutions. Comment. I'm sure that you're proud for your programs, and you will certainly like to show that to the others and comment the features that you used and how you designed them. So everyone handled out the solutions or not? All right. Yes, that would be nice. And there are these other sheets from the other group, maybe. You can bind them too. So, right. So, okay, I will check them offline, and I propose that some of you maybe shows the solution of the first exercise at the board and commence the solution. How about that? I mean, I can give your work back so that you use it for the presentation. Let's just so you used the lemma, but you didn't prove it. Okay, so present your solution as if the lemma was there, and someone else maybe proves the lemma. I give you the microphone. Since you're recording this anyway, I think.
Is this loud enough? All right. So we were supposed to show an equivalence between big step and small step semantics. That is, if we have a closed lambda term P, and that which direction? Right. That reduces via small step semantics to Q in some number of steps, then this is equivalent to P reduces to Q in big step semantics. And for brevity, I will just omit this notation here because it's clear what we're talking about anyway. So I will show this in two directions. First of all, from left to right. And this one should be fairly simple because, well, can be shown using this lemma. Oops. Which was if P reduces to Q and Q reduces to evaluates to a value, let's call it C, then we already have P evaluates to C2. So I did not prove this lemma. Some of you can do that, hopefully. But, well, we can show all of the rest with that. So as I said, I will prove this via induction. And this, of course, means that I need some sort of start. And the start is simply that if P is already Q, then that means, obviously that P reduces to Q in small step semantics, but also that P reduces to So P is equal to Q, and Q itself is, of course, that's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm actually trying to say is that if P has the form lambda x dot some P prime, so if P is already a value, then we have that P converges to this value in small step semantics, of course, because it is already a value, but also the same in big step semantics. Yeah. So this is the start of our induction.
So you do induction over what? You always carry induction over something, over number, over.
Over the steps of.
The number of steps.
Yeah.
Right? So over the length of this.
Exactly.
And this is like induction step where this length is zero.
Yeah. Okay, and basically the next step is to look at reduction chains with some number of.
So, the small correction here, it's not linear, I think. So this arrow which you used in the second. It says that you reduce to something, so there is actually a rule for that, but it's just equal. Yes, that would be correct, yes.
That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, that was all, or? It's correct other than that, or?
Yeah, it's correct, okay.
Yeah, of course.
Nitpicking because, yes,
yeah.
This is.
Okay. So that's part one. Part two is basically we assume that the claim, let's call it star, let's assume that star holds if P reduces to Q on n small steps. I'm not sure if there's some nice way to write this mathematically without just saying it in words.
Yeah, so often the notation for used for that is instead of you use the arrow and the star and n instead of the star.
Ah, that's good.
So P star n. Yes.
star n?
No, star just n.
Yeah.
And, okay. Q. Whatever. It means n steps. So yeah. It's like n times iterated.
Okay, and we basically now want to show that if this holds, then this also holds for all chains.
Here, I think n is greater than 0, right?
Yes. No, actually not.
I thought that was your base case when n was 0.
Yeah, well, but this is the assumption.
Ah, okay. Well,
and then obviously will be greater or equal. Obviously we need to show that p reduces in n plus, if p reduces in n plus 1 steps to q, and q is a value, then the condition holds too. And if p reduces to q in n plus 1 steps, that means there is some p tilde, for example, for which we have that p reduces to p tilde in one step, and this p tilde then reduces, of course, to q. But this also implies this already also implies, because this holds, that there exists some p tilde such that p to p tilde and p tilde converges in big step semantics to this q.
I think you've forgotten the indices in the sequence p tilde q.
Yes.
There must be n somewhere.
Exactly.
Yes.
And yeah, that should be it. And then by the lemma that we have, we know that p reduces or evaluates to q. And that's basically the one direction. Oops. Okay, and what's left is obviously the other direction, for which I will need to check my notes. So we want to use the somewhat more complicated well-founded pre-induction principle here. And for that, we need to identify what is the set of roots, what is the predicate, etc., etc. And the predicate I'm choosing to prove here is that, which I define on the terms P and Q, of course, and I say that the predicate is defined as P big step Q. And I'm saying this is true if from P evaluates to Q, it follows that P reduces to Q in some number of steps. Yeah. And the set of roots that we have is, of course, the set of the big step semantics roots.
Why do you need the premise for this implication?
Pardon?
The premise, so you say that your predicate
this one.
Should define here, yes, it's defined as an implication, but...
Well, maybe I have some sort of misunderstanding of how predicates actually work.
Yeah, well, predicate is like just a property, so you need to say what property of... Of this judgment you want to prove, so the property that you're proving is that p reduces to q, and... there is no assumption, because the left-hand side of the implication says that something that you have already, just states that your term in this form, but the terms that you consider are all of this form.
Okay. Well, I sort of interpreted this abstractly by saying this is just some sort of name for the object, and this is the actual semantic meaning, but it doesn't matter too much, so if we assume that this already holds, we can just cross this out. And this is all I'm saying then. So I need to change some of my proof then, but that should not be a problem. First of all, to show this, we need to prove the first point, that is for all roots of the form T. And this is, of course, just
so you can name it induction basics, so like you did it there.
Yeah.
So it's
And the rule is basically, well, yeah. So basically values evaluate two values, of course. And yeah, well, it's again trivial to show that this property holds here because, well, if we have a term, P evaluates the Q of this form here, then it's already clear that P and Q are equal. So P and Q are reduced trivially against each other. Like this.
I would use the same terms as you have on the left hand side because P and Q are taken. Yes. Yeah, so this is true because you take zero steps in this chain.
Yeah. And what's basically left to show is the second property. And how exactly do I write this? Yeah, so the second rule is how does one call it this in English? Induction step?
Induction step.
Okay. So that is P to Q. Q to Q prime and and substitute it, And then we have the product reduces to C2. So this means we can assume that the property here holds for these three terms. Like this, and and we want to show that the predicate holds for this term, and this should be quite simple to prove, actually.
I thought at the point one needed yet another lemma, but okay, go on.
Or just go on and.
So you could rewrite this predicate because this predicate, according to the definition.
These of course imply that, was that what you meant with lemma?
Yes.
So that's what I wanted to write then. The next step, basically, anyway. And we know that if these three terms are true, then this is, of course, also true. So we just need to prove that PQ reduces to C. Mm-hmm. And how do we do this? We just start with the term PQ. And then we apply the rules of small step semantics. And these, of course, say that, that because we have P reduces, I need to do this somewhat. I'll be a bit vague here and just explain what I'm saying in words. So we have that P reduces to Q in a finite number of steps. So this implies that, PQ reduces to, No, it's fine. Is it? I think I made a mistake here somewhere.
Yeah, p reduces not to q, but to q prime, p prime.
Should be this one, and...
Then for the term which reduces to c, it should also be p prime instead of p.
Pardon? Which one?
The third term, the one which reduces to c, it should be p prime.
Great. Thanks. Okay, and this should match the first rule. Yeah, it does. So we just substitute the first term, so to speak. Yeah. That's not actually quite what the first rule says, but we can easily see that, well, this reduces in some k number of steps, then we just need to apply the first rule k number of times consecutively. So, but this would be somewhat awkward to write, so just saying it.
No, that actually would be a lemma to prove.
Well, it's trivial to show where induction,
yes.
But yeah. Yeah, I guess. So then we have this one. And then we can apply the second rule, because what we need for that is that, right, that the left term here is a value. And we have that q reduces to q prime, so this one, maybe I wrote it like this, one and two. So this one reduces to lambda x p prime and q prime. By the very same logic, you can apply the second rule consecutively again, and then you get this. And then finally, we can we see that that q is a value, q prime is a value, because it has to be, because it's on the right hand side of the evaluation operator. And hence, by the third rule, which we actually just need to apply once, I think. Yeah. We have that this is equal to lambda x dot p prime, substituted such that instead of x we write. Pardon?
There's no lambda anymore.
At the moment there is still, I think.
Well,
isn't there?
Either you substitute x.
Oh, no, there isn't, right. I thought it dropped out after the substitution, but it doesn't indeed. So it's indeed pq and. Is it this one? And then we have exactly this property, and we know that since this holds, we also must have that this one holds, so this reduces to C, and that should conclude the proof, other than the lemma which I did not prove, but used in the first part.
Yes. So this is a correct solution. This is a correct word, but for a perfect solution, I would expect a better justification for this one and two transitions, because they are like they are the properties that you derive from the system. So they are not. Not there. So they are derived properties and in principle that that needs a justification. Although it's true, of course. That's just if you wanted to give a really perfect solution, that would it should be there. Yeah.
Okay. But the proof itself is really just induction or more complicated?
Yes.
Okay.
Otherwise, everything's fine.
All right.
Good.
All right, and then maybe someone can prove the lemma.
So. How about that? Paul? You prove it, did it somehow else?
I'm not sure I could just find this.
Improvise. Did someone prove the lemma?
I think it wasn't clear that you should.
It wasn't clear that you should.
Yeah, that you should.
Yeah, okay, but someone could do it. You mean I formulate it in such a way that it's not clear that you can use it without a proof. Can I have the exercise sheet? All right, and no one proved it. So I would propose that someone just does it on the spot. That shouldn't be difficult. I've tried it. It's not. It's straightforward, I think.
All right. So it will be more clear next time. Because when we say that you do something without your proof, then I explicitly say don't without a proof. The default is proof. But for you, the default is done for. Okay.
So, and lemma states that. I'll just omit the CVV. Right. Okay. Wait. Where's the lemma? There's the lemma. Okay. If we can go from P to Q in one step and Q converges to C, then so does P.
So I think one can prove it by induction over the complexity of P. So P is a term, and you consider just the cases like P is a variable, P is a...
Okay, so the thing I would have looked at is prove it on over... with induction over the derivation of of this one.
Yes.
Okay, so...
okay, well, but this derivation is it's one step, so you would... you would prove it by...
by induction on the small step rules.
I
mean, that one...
This is probably the same, because the rules are also correspond to the term structure. So the premise of a rule for the small step semantics is about the subterm of the target term. So you can do induction over the rules or the term structure probably would
Okay.
Yes, just go.
Okay, let's try it. Okay. We have a statement of this form, and we know that this has been derived by using the small step semantics rules. So now we can just do case analysis on which rule this was derived from. So which was the last rule we used to prove this? And so I guess you could say case one would be that the last rule that we used was this one. So now we have some renaming to do, I guess.
I would use S and T in the rule.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just leave it as is here, but so we say if this was the last rule we used, then we know that P must be of the form ST. Q must be of the form S prime T. And about C, we don't know anything right now. And now, what can we do? We can say,
Well, you use the induction hypothesis for the top. So effectively, you apply that tree induction lemma, saying that if it's proven for the premise of the rule, then you conclude it for the conclusion. So you use you assume that lemma holds for the top of the rule.
Okay. Yeah. So what we do is So we say that we need to give a name to the thing that P prime to the normal form of P prime.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
I will use the C star C prime because S prime can
relate to
C prime.
Sure.
Your local name.
Okay. So we have S prime evaluates to C prime. And now we should
And moreover you have
and
that S
so
S prime.
And we get it as. Okay, so we have these, then. By the induction hypothesis, we get that the normal form of S is not C, but C prime.
Yes.
And now we have to use a big step rule.
Yeah, I would just draw this rule. So this is the rule for the application, right? Because P is an application.
I don't think I see it right now.
I would just propose that you write it down. So for this concrete case. So we've got a rule for application in the big step semantics. And as a simplification, you just take ST.
Okay, so.
Yes.
So this is what we want to show, and now we have that. This is one ingredient that we need.
Yes, and we have this already. So it's this C prime is the one which we defined before.
Okay, then we say that, and let's say, well, C prime is a normal form, so it is something of the form lambda x, I don't know. No, t is bad. Let's say d.
Yes.
Okay. So let's put that here. Then we just say t converges to something. Let's call it, I don't know. Let's call it T prime, I guess. And then we say that, okay, we take D T prime x. Let's say this one converges to C, then we can prove that ST converges to C.
Yes.
And?
Yes, and this relies on the assumption that the C is taken from the corresponding rule for S prime T. So you also need but for S prime T.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so now we have to break up this one,
yes.
Basically. Yeah. Okay, so we have that. So we must have proved in some way that S prime T has C as a normal form. And the only rule that matches this is the second big step rule. And this one says, well, if S prime goes to lambda xd and t goes to t prime, and D with T prime submitted for X goes to C. So this isn't really written down in a nice way. So
yeah, you can read it from the bottom to top and from right to left.
Yeah. So the idea is that this must have been proven in some way, and for now we say it was proven using this rule. Then we also know this one must have been proven in some way, and the only way it could have been proven is by this. So we get from this we get D3, and now we use these two specifically here, and this one we obtain by using the induction hypothesis on this one.
Yeah, exactly, because S is a premise for the rule for ST, so we call the induction hypothesis for it. So since we know that, what we have on the right-hand side is our assumption. So all these parameters, D and T prime and C, are postulated because we use them as from the assumption, and we want to reuse them in the left-hand side. And for part of them, this is clear because they just repeat. So if t evaluates to t prime, of course we use it for the premise. Mm-hmm. Can use it again, and the same for d and t prime c substituted. And the crucial bit is this first component. On the right-hand side, we get s prime evaluates to lambda x d, and on the left-hand side, s evaluates to. How do you know that this is the same value? Because of the induction hypothesis, because this is precisely what the induction hypothesis tells us.
I mean, I guess the second case would be somewhat similar, so we can just write this one up more clearly, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, of course, the second case.
So the second case is if the last rule used. Last rule used in improving this one, that p goes to q in one step. That this rule was the second small step rule, which is t goes to t prime. S is a value, and we get that st goes to st prime. So we say this was the last rule. Then what we can now say is that now we say st prime has c as a normal form. Then we know, okay, this one is an application. So the only way this one could have been proven is by using, well, basically this rule here again. Let's just give the proper names to all the things. Okay, so we get basically the premises up here, which are that, what is it? I mean, we now have the t prime, so we need to rename this one, and also we have, okay, we say s goes to lambda x d. Well, in fact, we will just see that this is the same. Let's say the normal form of t prime is t double prime. And let's say that the normal form of d with t prime substituted for x is this one must be precisely this this c, because that's the rule we used. So what I just said is that since s is a value, we get in fact that s must be the same as lambda xd.
Where s is a value?
Because of this here, right? So now what do we do? Now we have to... Now, what we want to show is that that st, that the normal form of st is c. So we need to show these premises with t double prime here.
So, so one thing we need to do now is use the induction hypothesis on this one. And so t goes to t prime and t prime goes to t double prime. So we get that the normal form of t is in fact t double prime. And now we have basically everything we need for the rule. So now we just use the big step rule, which says that if s goes to lambda xd, so in fact I didn't need to state this one, and t has t double prime as normal form, and d with t prime substituted, t double prime substituted for x, just to see. So we have all these, and now we can conclude that the normal form of st is c. And this is exactly what we need to show in this case. Okay.
Yep. First.
Okay. So there is one more case. This one should be a bit different, I guess. So the last rule used in proving that p goes to q in one step was the third rule, which is that let's just give different names to all things. So if t is a value, then lambda xd applied to t goes in one step to not p, this one is d, t substituted for x. So this is now the last rule. So now we give a name to the normal form of this. So we say we call the normal form C. Yeah, and now I think we can just, do we even need the induction hypothesis here?
I don't think so, because the premise doesn't feature a statement to which the induction hypothesis would apply.
So we should just be able to, so what we then need to show is that lambda xd applied to t, which is now our left-hand side, converges to c. Well, and let's do just matching on the rule. And the rule says that, well, okay, let's just do it this way. So lambda xd, the normal form of that is of course itself. Then
Okay. T is a value, so we also get that the normal form of T is itself. Well, and this one we just claimed. So using these three, we can conclude this one. And that's precisely what we need. Okay. Yeah, so with these three cases, again using the tree induction principle, we can prove the lemma.
Exactly, perfect. Okay. Yes, so this is understood. Yeah, of course, this was the most interesting part, and actually, I expected that you prove it. But okay, next time I will be explicit about saying what should be proven. So what would you suggest? There are three more exercises. What do you think we should, in which order we should do them? We can look at the examples in Haskell, or we can just do everything in order. Do you have any preferences?
We are going to discuss all of them anyway.
Yes, but maybe for you, you like want to interchange somehow, because just proving things may be tedious, and like running programs is more like entertaining. I don't know. If you don't have any preferences, I would just go in order, right?
Let's do that then.
Yeah. So, what about the second one? Who wants to do it? Yeah, please.
Is it okay like this? Okay.
So
wir müssen eher zwischen. Okay.
So this were CPOs. And we had to prove that A times B is that CPO. And we have to show transitivity. So let's assume it's P1. Smaller. So we have from that that Q1 smaller than Q2, and here Q2 smaller Q3. So from that, because A is a CPO, we have Q1 smaller Q3, and likewise we have similar P1 smaller P3. So from this we follow Q1, Q3, P1. Smaller. So this is very basic. This one is clear, I think. Yeah. So reflexivity. We have P smaller P for every P element A and Q smaller Q for every Q and B. So it's clear that PQ smaller PQ. This is reflexivity. So we should show antisymmetry. So let's assume that P1
Q1 is smaller to Q2.
I wanted to make a short remark relating all this to Haskell a bit, because in Haskell, this order on pairs is defined pointwise. I know actually this word pointwise, and Haskell has an analogous feature of defining things pointwise. It's called derive. So you can define a data a piece of data like declare it like this, pair AB equal to, let's say, PAB, and say derived or, so you declare the, your pairs of elements from A and B, just like you do it here. And this keyword derived, it means that if your type supported the order, then this order inherited pointwise for the data that you declare. So I guess that it currently does all this proofs automatically for you, inherits the order. And for
the keyword is
one difference is that Haskell does this electric wrap key, right?
I don't think so. Okay, probably need to check it. We can check it.
The keyword is deriving, not derived.
Yes.
So we should check that supremas exist. So let's C be a chain. Mm.
so we can use the projections of the chain on A and B. So say CA is PE.
This would work with if you declared to be a member of the two classes equalities and orders, because orders are related to equalities, because for asymmetry you need to know notion of order. So this would compile them, but the order which is defined with the lexicographic is it.
So that you get a total order.
Well, it's the original order for total, but
yeah, but I think the odd factors is meant to encapsulate
all
the
orders.
I mean, otherwise
you cannot specify it, you can just put it in the command because the accents are not verified.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you don't have a partial, if you only have a partial order, I think you can't do things like binary search trees in a meaningful way.
So we have the suprema of chain A and the supremum of chain B. And PQ, is, which is the composition of the both suprema, is an upper bound to C. And we have to prove now that it's the lowest upper bound to C.
Yes.
It's clear that it is an upper bound. I could go more in detail if you wish, but I think it's clear.
I would propose just skip the list.
Okay. So let's assume we have another bound, upper bound. We know that P prime is in fact bigger than the supremum of CA. Which is P. And it's Q. So in fact, we have that PQ is the smallest upper bound. So PQ is the supremum of C.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of traditional in this theory, in this area, to use this big skew cup. I don't know what you call it.
Oh yeah.
Notation for the supremum.
Yeah, I used it for the other exercises.
Yeah, but it's alright. It's kind of tradition here. It's like when you read this, you in the paper that you kind of guess what the paper is about. Because if it's a mathematical paper, they would use the soup sign most likely.
So we have to prove number two. That this projection is continuous. I think I'll show it for projection one, and the other one is exactly equal. We need a chain. And we define P as the supremum of PE. And Q is the supremum of QE, which exists because if this is a chain, then P is a chain and Q is a chain. So we have projection one. So therefore, the projection one is continuous, and
I think we used
Oh, yes. Like this, yeah. So we have two continuous projections. Number three, we should show and we had to show that the right side exists, and I came to the conclusion that it doesn't exist. because we defined the supremum for chains, yes. And if this is what I think it is, so every combination from I's and J's, then this might not be a chain. But we define supremum only for chains. So if it's not a chain, it doesn't have a supremum.
The notion of a supremum is just a least upper bound. So for this supremum to exist, we need to show that this set has a least upper bound. And it doesn't have to be a chain.
If it is defined that way. A chain is a set with a complete order. So
I agree that this is not necessarily a chain, but
the supremum exists.
It still has a supremum.
Well, from the definition I took from the lecture, this the supremum isn't defined as a as the smallest upper bound from a set, from an ordered set, but from a chain. So it doesn't exist. So,
but if, for example, P1 is 1, and
I mean, this not, yes, this notation, this was not anyway. When we use this notation, we go beyond the notation which was introduced in the lecture, because in the lecture introduced the notation was one index only. So, and here I use two indices. Of course, then the question arises. So, what is meant that? That was the point of the exercise. I wanted to challenge you a bit because and time precise that said justify existence of the right hand side. So look at it and see that this thing exists is what I wanted to say. Of course, you need to argue why it exists. It doesn't. I mean, if it existed for free, I wouldn't say it. So it exists because I mean, you have to turn it into a. So because you've got two indices, it's not told here in which order you order this pairs, right? So and. The definition from the lecture doesn't apply, of course. So, did someone prove it? Paul? So, maybe yeah. You show something?
Okay, so my claim is that this least upper bound is in fact the same as this one. So we'll just show that it is that this is true, and at the same time show that it exists. So what we do is let's call this thing R. So to show that this R is a least upper bound, we first need to show that it is an upper bound. So for this, we can just say, okay, let's take just one of these pairs, Pi, Qj. Then we know that this is less than or equal than the pair which I get if I take the greater of the two indices, right? Because, well, we just need to, okay, Pi is less than or equal to than P max ij, and Qj is less than or equal to Q max ij, so this holds. Well, and this one is just an element of this chain, so of course, it is below R. So that's actually all we need to show for the upper bound part. So now let's say there is another upper bound, PQ. Now we need to show that R is less than or equal to this pair. Let's see. Can I see it? Okay, yeah. So, well, what this implies is that P is greater than all PI, and is greater than all qj, right? Because we just used the definition of this greater than or equal to on pairs. So this in turn implies that the least upper bound of the chain of the PI is less than or equal to P. Well, and same for the QJ. Well, and then we can just combine these again to get that R is less than or equal to the pair PQ, because R is just made up of these two things. So with these two things, we have shown that this R is a least upper bound for the set of these pairs. So this least upper bound exists and is equal to this one.
Right, we have to finish, and I think the rest is not difficult.